Talk given Sunday, 16th January, 1972. Those of us who are seriously concerned with religion have heard and read certain very important teachings where the religious life is concerned. Both the roots of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Kabbalah, as well as the Indian tradition, which is the original Veda, have an identical teaching. And fundamentally, this teaching is presented as the activity of energies. We human beings, constituted as we are acquainted with, in a practical way, only with that type of energy out of which the universe as we see it appears. This energy has its various forms in the world of affairs: electricity, heat, chemical energy, and so on. And these energies we know, we can measure, we can control. They are the energies which are the stuff of our individual being in this world. They are the stuff of all that is manifest and which we can examine in the universe. But we human beings, some of us at any rate, experience and realize for ourselves as the culmination of our religious life another type of energy which is a supreme mystery. It's immeasurable. It is unknowable. We can't deal with it, but it continually deals unto us. It is transcendent to us altogether. It is not something which we can ever know with the mind. The mind, as it functions in us, the mind with which we are acquainted in the ordinary way. But this energy, interestingly enough, has also been called mind. It was called All Father Mind in the Hermetic teachings, which are the Hellenistic form of original Egyptian teachings. It has been called Vahu Mano in the Zarathustrian teachings, the good mind. Vahu, good mano. Good in the absolute sense, not as the mere opposite in an ambivalent sphere of evil, but good in the absolute sense. It has been called mind only in Buddhism, especially Mahayana Buddhism, and so on. Now, this transcendent mind is, if you like to so call it, the divine virtue. Now, I deliberately use the word virtue. It is a power. It is creative power. And creative power is inseparable from creative action, from creation, which means action in eternity, not action as we know it with a cause-effect sequence through time. Please try to feel your way into this. Because this is of fundamental importance in understanding the whole question of the psyche, of the perfecting of ourselves, of the realization of holiness, and so forth. Now, this transcendent mind meets body. I can only put it in those terms. And as a result, there is in us human beings, in animals too, there is psyche. But the psyche of the human being can definitely be distinguished from that of the animal. I can deliberate transcendence. I can make smooth passage between time and the timeless. The donkey listening to the stars is also in communion. But the donkey listening to the stars is enfolded in a rhythm of life unconsciously. Whereas I make my transition, grace permitting, from time to the timeless. The donkey remains ever enfolded in this rhythm of universal life. Grace never forbidding. So you see, there is a very big difference between the psychophysical organism, which is the animal, and the psychophysical organism, which is a human being. Now, psyche is the link between matter and mind. Between body, individual body, and universal spirit. This, which is a universal energy, which is a transcendent energy, which knows no differentiation, which cannot be parceled out, allocated to, or seized by anyone, universally affects all limited, finite, particular creatures, beings, things. And in that affecting gives rise to its own reflection in human bodies. And this we call the psyche. So in that sense, the psyche is the special mind shape of this shapeless, formless, universal mind brought into being by virtue of the particular living individual body. Now let us be very careful here. The body, particularly brain and nervous system, the ductless glands, genes, hormones, all that sort of thing, constitute the physical roots of psyche. It is they which are the source out of which the particular mind shape, which is your psyche, comes into being and manifests. It is very important to grasp this. No body, no psyche. What we commonly call my mind, my soul, is just this, you see? And it has its roots in the body itself, in all the physical, chemical processes and activities of the body. They are physical processes. We can examine them, we can deal with them, we can change them, alter them up to a point. But only up to a point, because if we go beyond the point, we can wreck the body, we can kill it. Or we can make a person a lunatic. But this psyche, which itself is not a specific organ, like a liver or a heart or an eye or something like that, it's an unconfined thing. It's an elusive thing. This psyche, which, although it is special to you, is in a peculiar sense, it functions as if it extended out of you, right out, far out. We all feel what we call a psychical atmosphere. What meaning can there be to psychical atmosphere? We may venture to look at it a little bit analogically. We breathe in and out. When I have breathed in, and I use the term my in-breath, I am definitely referring to the volume of air which is at this moment actually inside my lungs. Now when I breathe out, that volume of air in a few seconds is quite untraceable. It has diffused into the room. Perhaps you have breathed it in, and so forth. Where is it? It's no longer my out-breath, in the sense that I can say my in-breath. Isn't that so? Now the psyche is something like this. And a psychical, and just as air comes out of a physical atmosphere, a gaseous atmosphere, there is this peculiar thing, psychical atmosphere. There is this peculiar affecting of one living brain by another living brain, and so forth. The transference of thought, the catching on of the other person's feeling or desire or whatever it may be. So psyche has this aspect also. It has both a particularized aspect and a diffuse aspect. And beyond the particularized and the diffused, there is that infinite transcendent reality of pure mind, absolute mind. The spirit, call it what you like. Now, we must bear that in mind very carefully. Look now at another aspect of transcendent energy. Without calling it mind, because of course the moment we use a word, we are creatures of our conditioning. And the meaning of the word, as we ordinarily know it, naturally gets transferred to the other thing, which we mustn't do. Now just think only in terms of transcendent energy. Just try and feel it, you see. This transcendent energy is creative energy, creative power, the divine virtue, strength, power. And it is inseparable from creative action all the time. Creation is there perpetually. Creation is the manifestation, the appearance of the living activity of this transcendent creative power. Note carefully, it is the appearance. In the Vedic tradition of India, this transcendent energy is named Brahman, sometimes it is named Atma. They stand for the same thing identically. And as a result of Brahman being Brahman, there is the universe, which is the appearance, the shape of the shapeless, the limited form of the unlimited formless. The unlimited formless knows neither birth nor progression nor death, but the limited form knows perpetual change. Birth, origination, process, growth, decay, death. But in terms of the one total reality, this death is an emergence of being into non-being. Being is limited, particularized. If it fulfills its purpose, as it emerges into non-being, it totally loses any individuality, absolutely gone. There is no I am I involved in that at all, or left. But it has somehow produced some influence by which determines the next emergence back into being of this universal non-being. Look, this is a very difficult subject. Extremely difficult. You have to follow it very carefully, sort of just see it. This movement from limitation, from form and shape, from subjection to birth and death, from being enclosed in the sphere of mortality into the unlimited, the immortal, the absolute, the totality, the shapeless, formless. The absolute is. In which there is no survival of the separate I-ness. No separate I, no separate being, no separate object, energy, force, anything remains as a separate thing on emerging into non-being. This is a mystery the intellect will never grasp. Intellect cannot grasp it. You cannot raise up a logical, philosophical system on the basis of it. But if somehow there has been this magic of realization, and the perfected holy ones did realize, that's how the teaching is there. And the teaching is identical in disparate, separate great traditions, the Judeo-Christian, the Kabbalah, and the Indian with the Veda, the original Veda. If there is a realization in some form or other, then you can affirm it, you can speak about it, authoritatively too. But what is spoken must not be taken by the listener as authority. Beware of this. If you take it as authority, you will always misconceive it, misinterpret it, and in consequence, misapply it. Just try and follow it. And don't do anything more with it, because you're dealing with power, and it will have subtle effects on the psyche, which will interfere with the happy course of your life. Now, this creative power, in its perpetual creative activity, having produced the appearance of itself, comes up against its own creation. I said earlier, the link between pure creative power and body I put it in the terms of mind meeting body, the link is psyche. Now the tendency of psyche and the tendency of the whole psychophysical organism, because it is preponderantly feminine, whether you are a male in body or whether you are a female in body, makes no difference. It is preponderantly feminine. And it is that femininity which is concerned with preservation. With preservation. It wants to continue as a self-conscious I am I. But this creative power brooks no obstruction to fresh creation, so it disrupts the old. It neither sends you to heaven nor to hell. It just disrupts. Therefore, there is the inevitability of death. The absolute inevitability of death for everything which is an appearance. Now look into your Buddhist statement. Whatsoever hath a beginning, by nature hath an ending. Man fears death out of his ignorance. He fears it. He tries to avert it. He tries to prevent it coming. Futile attempt. Wasted energy. Let death come at its own time as it will. Be concerned with living now. And then death will come at the right time as the complete and perfect consummation of a life which is truly virtuous. Because you have lived now. And if you live now, wholly attentive to the now, all selfness is out. And the self is the pure manifestation of that supreme absolute reality, which is the totality, the unknown and the unknowable totality. In this way, death is the portal. You will realize it, you will experience it as the portal to immortality. But there is no such thing as my immortality or your immortality, because that is a stupid misconception of continuance of a separate, limited something in time and space, which is a wearisome affair. What shall it avail a man? You know the words of Jesus. Don't try to save yourself. If you do not bend your energies to saving yourself, salvation in its reality will be there. This is how you make, I'll use my phrase which I used a little while ago, this is how you make smooth passage between time and the timeless. Recognize, acknowledge, and be lovingly obedient to that supreme eternal law by which the whole process goes on. What is you is one and the same as that transcendent eternal reality. But because we are conditioned in the way we are, we seek to grab a bit of transcendence, of eternity, and claim it as myself. And this is the folly and the stupidity of man. And so the millions and the thousands of millions of human beings die, not in terms of supreme consummation into perfection, into immortality, but as material which has failed to fulfill the divine purpose and is just cast away into the waste paper basket. Death comes that way. Death is just the disruption minus the enlightenment. Don't fight against the fear of death. Don't be anxious about solving the problem. There is no solution to the problem. There is only a resolution into divine harmony of your total being. That is your fulfillment. Please, do try and get hold of this. It will transform your whole understanding of life, if you do get hold of it. This transcendent creative energy then brooks no resistance, whereas the feminine part wants to preserve and perpetuate the form. The masculine part, the transcendent energy itself, which is masculine, feminine, in perfect harmony, just smashes up whatsoever obstructs its creative activity. So this feminine part, which we will call the psyche for convenience, one term instead of trying to put many thoughts together one after the other. This psyche, which is the feminine part of us, which is mortal, if there is an awakening inside ourselves, instead of trying to preserve now, does something quite different. It allows itself to be freed out of its ambivalent, miserable existence of the everlasting battle, the conflict between virtue and vice, allows itself to be transformed into pure virtue. And this is where the whole teaching of desirelessness has its supreme significance. What is a desire? This particular psyche wanting to hold on to what it considers desirable, pleasant, in other words, and to avoid what it feels or considers as painful. It is this particular psyche which will console itself, which will satisfy its vanity, its conceit, its egoism, when it bends its energies to serving God, to propagating the gospel, to all the other nonsense which has gone on for 100,000 years. No. Let the psyche awake. And the instrument of awakening, the instrument of salvation, is your power of attention. Let the psyche awake to its real destiny, this destiny of being utterly transformed from a mortal which holds back the divine process, or tends to hold back, and in that holding back, it opposes the unopposable, the invincible. You see? It's the transformation out of this state into one of dancing in tune with, in harmony with the creative activity. And then what happens? The psyche itself continuously lives in time and space, in harmony with that transcendent divine rhythm of life, other life, life, other life. From being into non-being, from non-being into being, from being into non-being, non-being into being. And thereby the cruel, the tragic divorce between self and not self, which we raise up through our ignorance, between man and God, between creature and creator, all that is completely out. Realize this in the depths of your heart, in your awareness, and see how it transforms your entire approach to life in its totality, to your whole stance in the world in which you live. This is something utterly new, utterly different. Now, I've tried to present this very briefly out of the fundamental roots, whether it be through the Kabbalistic approach or through the Vedic approach. This is the kind of thing that happens. Now, the heart of religion is fundamentally concerned on its practical side with the transformation of the psyche. The transformation which takes the psyche out of its constricted mortal state, releases your psyche into being the soul of the world, so that your mind, your heart, is no longer an enclosed, separate thing, but is absolutely empty, transparent, unresisting, infinitely resilient to the divine creative power which just flows in and out freely. Religion is concerned with that kind of transformation. You see, the power aspect of religion is that. It has nothing to do with all this childish, footling, psychical phenomena and all the rest of the baby stuff. Now please, when you listen to these things, don't try to fit them into your own conditioned way of looking at things. If you are a Buddhist, you will seek to interpret what is said in Buddhistic terms. Does it agree with what the Buddha said? Does it, that is to say, with what I think and know as what the Buddha said? He may never have said it at all. And if he said it, what he meant is something different from what you and I mean. Let's be rid of that conceit anyway. If you're a Christian, particularly if you're a fundamentalist, you will want to interpret it all in terms of the literal word of the Bible. And my goodness, if a fundamentalist were to study Hebrew very carefully and English very carefully, he will soon start scratching his head as to what exactly is the literal word of the Bible. Because the translations are so hopelessly different in certain important respects from the original Hebrew, which in its turn misrepresents the Kabbalah in certain respects, which was an esoteric oral teaching and tradition. You see? If you are a theosophist, you'll want to, you know, make what I say fit into all your theosophical framework. If you're a Steinerite or, well, Xite or Jite or any oldite or ologist or whatever you are, you'll try to fit it into that. If you want to do that, you're wasting your time. Go home and have a good rest and a good sleep. a bottle of rum beside you would be more amusing and so. No, don't try to do that. Listen with a completely open mind. What happens when you listen? Have you ever actually observed the process of your listening and your looking? As you're looking, as you're listening, your brain's chattering back at what you're looking at, what you think you're listening to. Look, this, I'm giving you the real technique of the religious life, if I may use such a phrase. But people never seem to grasp it, that this is the real technique. Not looking at your clock and saying, 6 o'clock, time for meditation, getting cross-legged or cross-eyed or whatever it may be, and going through a ritualistic verbal mumble in your mind. Now we shall send out loving thoughts to Jimmy Brown, who's got a broken nose. Now we shall think of the Master and make the picture of perfection before us to which we shall aspire. All rather childish baby play. Now don't do that. The good God gave you your senses. Use them. Don't be senseless. Be sensible. Look and be well aware of the chattering back of the brain at what you're looking at. Because this is our conditioning. Inevitable, unavoidable. It is part of the process. Because who can know freedom unless he has known constraint? The one who is eternally free from beginning to end, there's no problem of realizing freedom for him. It is because we have been through constraint that we dream of freedom. Now this is the way to freedom. I put it badly. There is no way to freedom. Freedom is here and now. My business is to clear out all that obstructs this freedom, which is right within me, everlastingly. So you see, when these things are said, beware of making them fit into your previous conditioning, SES or Uspensky or whoever and whatever it may be. You might wonder, good gracious, is Feroz Mehta setting himself up above all these? Not at all. He is neither above nor below or on the same level. We are met here together, and this person called Feroz Mehta is merely the mouthpiece of the inner depths of your own minds and hearts, which are perfect and free, transcendent within, is just the mouthpiece. This man is just the mouthpiece, however poor it may be, or however good it may be. Don't try to measure that. But it's the mouthpiece through which all that comes out. So it's your opportunity. It's your springtime. Take advantage of it while the spring is here. And use it rightly. So, understand this. And then, I've taken a long time to come to the main point from which I started. As regards the psyche. Then the psyche no longer tries to stave off death, but in tune with that transcendent life, other life, pulsation of totality, of transcendence, it experiences existence, non-existence, life, death, knowledge, and the absence of knowledge in the immediate moment, continuously. Have you ever in your lifetime, you may have, I do hope you have you ever in your lifetime been through this sort of extraordinary experience, that at some point or other, you really saw the truth of something. And when you really saw the truth of that something, you completely let it go. No more grasping. I'll give you a trivial case in point. This is a true thing which happened. It didn't happen to me because I never did smoke. But a man who was addicted to smoking one day suddenly took his cigarette out of his mouth, gave a puff and said, "Really, this is quite unnecessary." Threw the cigarette away forever. Finished. He was just utterly free of it. Now, this is liberation. No more struggle thereafter. No more confinement to the ambivalent sphere. Now the psyche is the sphere in which we experience our whole ambivalence. Good, bad, pleasure, pain, lust, love, whatever you like, everything. It's the realm of ambivalence. But if you are attentive, and this power of attention, remember, is your power of salvation, your instrument of salvation. If you're really attentive, you won't be tossed about like a straw, this way, that way, all the time. But you will live completely and totally because of that total attention, without the interference of the conditioned mind at the back of it, and you will die immediately to the whole experience. You'll have finished with it. Because by total attention, the whole essence of the experience is realized and is brought to fruition in terms of pure intelligence in you. This is what happens. Now, you see, you have acquired nothing, you have achieved nothing, attained nothing, gained nothing, because this power of pure intelligence, which this faculty of pure intelligence which emerges, is not something of the nature of a property. It is a universal transcendent reality which just functions through you, even as physically space is the universal, indescribable, formless, shapeless reality in which we exist and which exists through our bodies. That is the mystery of space. And pure intelligence, pure mind is like that. So you can't acquire it and say, "This is my intelligence." It is just intelligence functioning, that is all, through that particular living body. Now you see, this is mind in freedom. This is the meaning of freedom. This is the natural state of the mind. Tibetan Buddhism has talked about it, but I don't know whether it has ever put it in these, I don't think it has ever put it in these terms. And I think you will find that these terms, if you can really grasp them, will clarify your own understanding of it. So you see, what was my psyche, the mortal, has transformed into the immortal soul of the world, if you like, to put it so. And in that is your liberation. So now, religion is concerned with this sort of thing. Fundamentally, it is a teaching, that is to say, the ethical, metaphysical teaching which comes under the category religion, not metaphysics as ordinary metaphysics, but this aspect of metaphysics, the metaphysics of religion and, of course, ethic. And ethic, in this case, not the ambivalent ethic of, oh, you must suppress the evil and cultivate the good and all that nonsense. You can't do either. In actual fact, you see, the teaching of religion is a teaching of psychology. The science of the psyche, of the soul, and its transformation. Now note very carefully, if you can't get hold of what I said earlier on from the beginning, today's has been rather a difficult talk, but I hope you will get hold of it. If you can't grasp that, do grasp this. The psychology which the world of scholarship, the world of the researcher knows, is the psychology of man in his ill state. Man functioning ambivalently. The professional world of psychology and the academic teaching of psychology knows nothing about the psychology of the perfected Holy One. Only the perfected Holy Ones knew it. So they knew both aspects. This ambivalent morality, which is a state of conflict, which you can never resolve if you remain stuck in ambivalence. That is what the academic world examines and understands and so forth. But the perfected Holy Ones knew that. They also knew the transcendence thereof. The perfecting of the individual and his liberation. The fulfillment of the real purpose of your existence in the light of this creative power and its activities. Have you ever met a perfected Holy One? You may have, but unless you yourself are something like that, you'll never know. Unless you yourself are like that, you'll never know. This is a perfected Holy One. When Mozart heard Beethoven play, improvise, and saw some of his compositions, he recognized, and he said, "You listen to this young fellow." Beethoven was only 21 when Mozart died. But Mozart said, "You listen to this young fellow. He will shake the world with his music." Mozart knew. Even Haydn didn't quite recognize the genius. If a Buddha meets a Christ, they just know, yes. So, if we meet a perfected Holy One, would we know? If I present you with the Kohinoor and another gem looking exactly like it and equally large also, unless you're an expert jeweler, would you know the difference? No, you won't. So the perfected Holy Ones knew what it meant to become utterly purified. And their religious teaching, therefore, is couched in the forms, in the verbal forms, best calculated to help the individual who really cares to bring about that transformation of the psyche. from the ill state into the whole state, from the condition of dukkha into the condition of nirvana. But unfortunately, so much of those teachings have become garbled. What has come down is the written word, and the written word has, through literally thousands of years, through millennia, not only centuries, got just ever so slightly edited and re-edited and re-edited, watered down, altered, befogged, besmirched, spoiled to such an extent that there's a considerable amount of garbled stuff now existing. And that garbled stuff constitutes our beliefs, our firm convictions, our ideas, of a particular system of thought, of teaching, of meditation, of practice, and goodness knows what not. You see what has happened there, therefore? We go the way not of the living being, but the way of the machine. If you are concerned with the worldly sphere of science, invention, medicine, industry, art, all the rest of it, there, of course, you can learn the techniques, the know-hows, the skills. Because that is the sphere to which all this belongs, the mortal sphere. There you acquire knowledge, which is perfectly right, and you utilize it technically. But the acquisition of knowledge and the using of it technically is that which is external to your living being and very largely external to your living process. But spiritual realization, the flowering of transcendent love and wisdom, is a process of the growing of me out of ignorance, the state of ignorance, incapacity, stupidity, selfness, and so forth, into the living image of the divine perfection. And it's a living process. Now, being a living process, you and I can never control it or predetermine it by our thought or by what we are taught by others. You see, we can't be taught it. We are under the illusion that we can. You and I were all born, and we grew up. That is how we are here. Whether we are young, or whether we are middle-aged, or whether we are, like myself, infinitely old. So we are here by virtue of that living process. Now, right from my infancy onwards, was I ever able to dictate to the life process how it shall make this psychophysical organism grow? Could I dictate to it? This person grew by virtue of this mystery, life at work. This marvelous, transcendent, divine mystery. That is why the study of physiology is so helpful, so useful for the spiritual life. You begin to sort of see the wonder and the marvel which is greater than oneself, completely beyond oneself. It is that which brought it to this stage. Now, if I try to be clever about it, because of my conceit, if I try to subserve my vanity by wanting this to be otherwise than what it was and how it was growing, you see, I'd most probably ruin my own health and my well-being. Isn't that so? Could we interfere with the processes of life? And in this connection, if you like, read the book of Job, especially the last few chapters. Wonderful wisdom there. So whilst in the sphere of ambivalence we acquire knowledge and technique and skills and so forth, in the sphere of life, wisdom just grows by itself and flowers out. I can't dictate to it. I cannot desire it, because my desire will besmirch it, will be an obstruction to it. Just let it be. This is the meaning of faith. In Christianity, faith has its own specific form of presentation. In Buddhism, it has its own specific form of presentation. But both Buddhists and Christians, all the others also equally, quite fail to understand what on earth faith means. What on earth it actually is in its essential real nature. Don't try to grasp it with the brain. You never will. Don't give way to an emotionalism, just an immature expression of a weak physical organism. Don't give way to immature emotionalism and say, oh, my faith. It's just sheer nonsense. Just be quiet and watch. See what happens. So now, the Holy Ones gave that teaching of religion, which is the teaching of psychology. The psychology of the perfected state, and showed mankind in a few simple ways just how the ill psyche is released into the whole and the healthy psyche. I've said this before again and again. The fundamental basic thing is simple morality. Pure morality. And I've said 100 times, 1,000 times, if I've said it once, your instrument of salvation is your power of attentiveness. Attend to what we call the without as well as the within. If we don't attend to the within, it's useless attending to the without. Do not indulge. Do not fight against. And in that state, this mystery, this marvelous thing, this thing of wonder, this thing of sheer happiness and beauty, your own life energy, your own life power, unobstructed by all one's own weaknesses and so forth, will work in harmony with that transcendent energy and bring you to your fruition, which is the supreme way in which the world and its problems can also find their resolution.